Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, what's up, guys?
After Things is the show where we talk about being a creative, about trying to build businesses, trying to succeed, make it in life, just get by, where to bury the bodies in the desert, etc. Couple of guys still trying to figure it out, and we welcome questions from people, and you know, we'll give you our point of view on this, but this ain't like Shark Tank where we really think that we are the end all be all and know what the heck we're doing.
Though we did used to call this segment Weird Tank.
So yeah, we do Weird Tank when people propose business ideas. Then it becomes Weird Tank, and then we will. Well, you know, based upon our track record of launching
a decent small niche podcasts.
Yes. So, first time listener, James Harrison. By first time, I mean first time he's hearing this episode. James has been with us forever.
Yeah, by the way, for the record, we were singing your praises, James. I know he's listening right now, but James, one of the good ones. He's been a fan for a very long time, and I feel a vested interest in seeing him succeed.
So, yeah, one of you guys has got to make it because we are out of options for ourselves.
Look, man, we fertilized 10,000 eggs for a reason, all right?
Yeah, we're open. One of you is the next Zuckerberg or whatever, or Travis Kalanick. We get a call. We get some stupid paid job for consulting for some, you know, flash in the pan internet company. Their plan. So he writes, here is one for all of you. Have any of you ever had to deal with imposter syndrome? If so, how do you deal with it? Is it something one should concern themselves with or just get your head down and pull through the feelings? If not, what things do you do to stop yourself from having it? So imposter syndrome is where you kind of feel like you don't belong, kind of like you feel like your people are going to at any moment realize that you're kind of full of it, that you are a pretender, that you just aren't that. And I'm going to say, nope, speaking for Justin and Brian, nope, no imposter syndrome here. Next question, moving along, not going to think about that one.
Yeah, no. Who asked about that? Was it anybody else? Anybody? Is it, you know? I mean, yeah. I just wanted to quash this one down. Definitely not an imposter here. Nope, genuine article, real McCoy, right here for you. Yeah, all right, Brian.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I mean, the answer is yes. Of course, we all suffer it, but it's doubly weird. And I guess James is in the same group as we are because very few people have to pick up the phone. And I'm going to use an old metaphor, you know, and design a Yellow Pages ad shouting about how great they are. And so it's like you're faced with this very real moment when it's like, am I lying if I don't think I'm that great, but I have to design an ad saying how great I am to buy my show or visit me or come? I don't know.
I think part of it is the very nature of fame and success, right? You know, we inherently can design our barriers on what we think is famous or valuable or important, and we believe that they, them, it are other than us, right? It's the reason why we get nervous when we meet our heroes, because they're separate from where we are. We live in normal world. They live in whatever hyperspace, super productive dream world. And when you are trying to get to those spots and try to get to those places and advance your career, you know, you got to kind of model it, even if you don't feel that you don't feel the same way about yourself as you do about them. And that never goes away.
Well, and I think that's the fantasy is you want to believe like wherever someone is, they didn't do that in your world. They did that in the awesome plane of reality that celebrities, you know, in Asgard, basically. And it's like that's the weird part is like they still only got 24 hours a day. They still only have 200 to 300 people they can name in their tribe. You know,
think about one of your favorite idols, one of the people you look up to. OK. Right now, one of them is in a meeting or somewhere trying to hold in gas.
Yeah.
They're like trying to be like, oh, God, if I can't, I should not have had, you know, Chipotle before. This is really not good. I need to invent an excuse to go to the bathroom. I mean,
for me, the weird part is picturing them switched off like whatever it is you see them doing. Like picture Bill Nye. Every time you see him, he's dynamic and excited and wants to, you know, but then there's times that he wants Bill time and he's just like, just leave me alone. Just get out of here. I mean, I don't mean to make up things like I know personally, but like you could do this for anybody. Picture them switched off, just needing some time to regroup. And that alone gives you an interesting introspection.
That's kind of interesting. It's been for me has been coming out to LA and you're around a lot of celebrity and then you go to parties and then you hang out with people and then you see that person on TV who plays that cool role and you realize how awkward they are at a party, you know, and you realize that, you know, and when they're not like with people going up to like, you're great, when people aren't doing that, they don't know how to function or have conversation.
And it really is. I used to get so much anxiety on Scam School about like, I was like, it didn't work. That pause was terrible. They weren't very fooled or whatever. And then I saw the magic that editing could do. And it took a long time for me to get to the point where I was relaxed enough to where like, even if something goes sideways, I realized it was more important for me to keep my composure and just trust that the edit would save the day. That doesn't exist in real life. In real life, you get to own all your flaws and foibles and, like think about all of the action stars and superheroes that benefit very heavily, not only from editing, but also competent direction, pacing, good story, awesomely written lines and all that stuff. I would imagine. Can you imagine how terrifying imposter syndrome must be to those larger than life characters that they built for themselves and that they're
known as? That's why they go through such ego problems and stuff is because they're constantly, and I can think of in Magic at least one personality who's just torn apart every relationship he's had with people because he suffers about immensely. And I've been at parties like Friends of Throne that are nice little get together kind of thing. And you know, and I've seen super famous people just standing there waiting for somebody to talk to them because they don't know how to initiate a conversation. And then when you do, you're like, nobody ever even talks to this person. You know, they're just used to like having, you know, talking to assistants or being on a set and all that. And when they're just in a room with a bunch of other people that are not indifferent, but are like, oh yeah, it's cool, you do that thing, but they just can't function. And you realize that like internally, that's a thing people go through. So,
as Hop happens in Hollywood or whatever.
Brushwood, guys. I'm talking about Brian Brushwood.
Oh, okay. I knew it. Yeah. I'm Morgan Freeman. You hear a lot of stories of celebrities breaking down or being divas or prima donnas or whatever. I would say so many of those stories are people who were inadequately prepped for the situation that they put into and they didn't expect through some breakdown of communication, either that or insecurity. You know, I heard about some actress who on set just, you know, torpedoed so much stuff, threw a fit, insisted on rewrites and all this stuff. And I'm like, those aren't the actions of somebody who feels like they belong there and that this is their space. Those are the actions of somebody who feels in over their head and desperately wants to lash out to those things. And so, you know, when I heard that same story that was clearly meant to spark outrage and fury, all I felt was pity for that person.
It's
I was
about,
like,
yeah,
what a rough situation.
Part of the problem that happens in celebrity too is that everybody who makes money off of you, you know, they never want to tell you they're upset or they're angry. Cause if you have agents and stuff and you're doing well, your agent's constantly afraid that you're going to leave or go elsewhere. So if you're acting like a jerk, they're just going to make apologies to producers or whatever. And you go through these situations where people around you never check you. Like your friends are never there to check you, or your friends who are there, they're the ones that don't have a lot going on in their life. So they can fly out to LA and hang out with you 24/7. And so they become your entourage and sort of dependent upon you in some respects. And so you get into this bubble. And then when you're on a set and you're dealing with somebody like a director who's a strong personality who has to get things done, you'll get these clashes because it's like, hey, that's great that you have this little bubble where everything you do, everything you say is funny and great and everything loves that you do, but I need you to do this right now and you can't boss me around. Or when you can, those movies tend to suck because
and keep in mind that
people I respect ruined.
There's a functional aspect to that bubble. These are people who are paid. Like their job is to walk into a room and exude confidence and charisma and feel like they're just nailing it. Whether they are or they aren't, they need to feel that way. And it's kind of like I'm terrible at basketball. And before I ever goof off and even practice basketball, I'll make sure to like stand directly under the net and sink like 7 in a row and then take a half step back and be like, oh, that's right, that's right. Otherwise, I just come in as a wobbling mash of neurosis and it's no good.
Well, let me take this out a little bit from, you know, the celebrity side to even the more workaday elements that I think we've all sort of, you know, obviously, you know, joked about the fact that we feel imposter syndrome about, because if you break it down, it's not only what you think of other people, but it's what you think of yourself, right? But it is, to me, 50% on either side. Like, you can be totally right in terms of your self-worth, and you'll still think that these other people that are doing what you want to do or are doing something extraordinarily well that you appreciate and understand to be great are better than you. And similarly, you can have a great idea that everybody's human and they put their pants on one leg at a time and be a mess internally, and you're still going to have an imposter syndrome. Like, there are two steps to mitigating its corrosive effects on your life.
One of the things to think about too is, I remember when I was a kid, my dad made some comment. My dad's not an arrogant guy in the world. He said that, said, you know, I consider myself the best in the world. I'm like, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, I play basketball better than most of the people in my office. I'm like, okay, but I don't play basketball better than you know, an NBA player. But he says, my dad at the time was on like the firearms team, but like I can shoot a gun better than they can. He knows how to hold it too. You know, he says that, and then I could do gymnastics. My dad explained, like, I've got all the, you know, he says, you have all these different skills that make up who you are, and I'm not going to be better than anybody necessarily in one particular thing, but you add together enough skills and you're really an accomplished person in your own way. And that's been kind of my life, has been about acquiring skills that I may not be the best at, but I might be really good at. And that's, I'm going to be enough of it that I will feel confident about it. And then, you know, I think I'm a good writer. I don't think I'm a great writer, but I feel good enough about my writing. I feel good enough about my magic and good enough about these things that, you know, some people could say be focused. But then I thought about that deeply and I said, you know, what I can do though, when I wanted to get into magic and I said, hey, I wanted to get into illusion design, is not a lot of people try to design illusions. It's a very, very small group of people. And I said, you know, I could study it and learn about it, and I could be one of the top illusion designers there was. And by the time I was just, you know, still in my early 20s, people were doing my magic, performing around the world. And I had confidence and I felt less like an imposter because I had accomplished something. People did it. And it wasn't a crowded niche. It wasn't like, yeah, I rose through the cutthroat ranks of illusion design to become, you know, I'm like, you know, one of, you know, two people who said, hey, I want to become this. I want to do this thing. And if I spend enough time on it, I'll be good at it. If everybody tried to do it, then no, I would not be top ranked there.
Right. Well, and that's the benefits of an inefficient market. That what you're touching on is one of my favorite parts from that Scott Adams book, How to Fail at Nearly Everything and Still Win Big. He talks about how it's better to be good at two things than the best at one thing. And he points out, he says, you know, you could be the best plumber in LA, but you're going to make less money than a good plumber who also is good at speaking Spanish. Like that crossroads between two different skills is going to be where most of the opportunities lie, because that list of plumbers is going to be huge. That list of plumbers who also speak Spanish and also maybe have a clever jingle or whatever is going to be vanishingly small. And now you have an inefficient market that you can afford to out hustle the other guys and perform.
We know a guy in magic, and I'm not going to single him out here, but I would say he's one of the finest close-up magicians in the world. One of the finest. He's amazing. He is, and he's hilarious. And if he's listening to this, he knows exactly who we're talking about. And he suffers from imposter syndrome like you wouldn't believe. You know, I've done shows with him, like big lineups and stuff, and he is hands down the best person in the, you know, out of everybody there performing. He's incredibly talented, but he's got this. But I would say for him, it's like clinical. Is that I could lay out all these examples of like, no, this is why you're good. This is why you're great. You don't need to worry about it. But he just can't. And that's a problem. Like, I don't know if there's any sort of talk therapy can help, because this guy just, it's so deep ingrained. It's part of the reason he is one of the best in the world is because he's driven by that imposter syndrome. So he's nonstop practicing, and you just see him do these insanely sick sleights that you're like, that's wasted on 99.99% of people. But for him, he does them because he has such a fear that, well, people are going to find out that I'm a phony. And it's like, if you can do that, how could you possibly be a phony?
Well, and that's the tough thing is you can't logic it away. This anxiety attacks, panic, like you can't logic it away. That's which is part of the reason I'm so forgiving to celebrities surrounding themselves in bubbles. Like you know, even
and yes,
you know, by
it's
some
Brian
accounts.
Brushwood, guys.
Yes. Again.
Oh, another one.
But yeah, that's the thing. It's a logic. I think that sometimes you can. I mean, some people can, some people can't. I can logic away certain kinds of anxiety and stuff because I always try to have a very rational, what is my metric? How do I measure this? You know, and if that measurement makes sense, then I will move forward on it. I won't think about it, but that's tricky. Not everybody does that.
And you know, I think for our friend, the magician, it's hard, you know, because you say, okay, you can't logic it away. That's a complicated thing for me because very often the worst psychological damage that we can do or I can do to myself is when I'm using very logical progressions, right? You know, I'm using the, you know, what I'm going to couch to myself as kind of harsh reality into negative or destructive territory. And it's not to say that you're not going to better yourself by being tough on yourself, because very often you are. But there is that line when it stops becoming about working out the muscle and starts becoming about tearing it off the bone.
Yeah, but I wonder, I think sometimes it depends from where you start. Like what's the problem you're trying to solve? And I go through, every time I write a book, you go through that anxiety, like, does this book suck? Does this book suck? And I can either approach it from one point of like, well, let me obsess about all the flaws on there. Let me obsess about that. Or I can take it from the point of view and say, well, in objective reality, for some people, the book will suck. For some people, the book will not suck. What are the criteria? And I can sort of, you know, get to that point where I'm like, oh, well, I also have this, I have an editor or I have an agent that will read it first. If it sucks, she will tell me that sucks, but I've got enough track record with her. I can give her a couple suck books and I'll still be fine. You know, and then I can sort of rationalize like, yeah, I should submit this. I should click send. I shouldn't keep worrying about this because the cost of not submitting it is greater than the cost of sending it and being, eh, we need to rework it. I have enough track record now as a writer that people know I can do good stuff. And that took me building up incrementally. So I can, and I know like now I'm like, yeah, generally my book's been getting better and better reviews, but I know that there's going to be points where I may try to reach a little bit further or I make many mistakes and that may not happen where I might get books that aren't as well reviewed. I don't want that to happen, but I'm okay with that happening because I know, rationally speaking, what I can and cannot do.
So if I hear you correctly, like one of the things is you can't – what I meant when I said you can't, you know, rationalize stuff away, you can't logic it away is in the heat of the moment you find yourself trapped and there's no out. But you can logically create a framework that keeps you – filled. You could say like, okay, this is the fuel that I seem to run on. This is what I've done before to access that awesome win state. How do I maximize my opportunity to make that happen?
Yeah, you know, let's take an example. That's like somebody like James or somebody who's a close-up magician. Okay, and I was talking about this yesterday with a friend. Performing close-up magic is tremendously anxiety-inducing because most of the gigs that you're doing are you're in environments where you've got to go up to people and say, do you want to see magic? So right out the gate, you deal with rejection. Right out of the gate, as soon as you step into there, you're going to deal with somebody saying no. Yeah. And as a lot of people, for me, that was always – I would get hired to do events and I'd find out it was like a reunion and people just wanted to talk to each other. And the last thing they want is magic boy stepping up in there, because my job as a magician is to facilitate and to get people together in a close-up environment, was to get people together, to spur conversations and have people do fun things. My job was not to entertain people who are already being entertained and enjoying the conversation, you know, enjoying the presence of their friends, right? And sometimes I would get hired by events. I'm like, this coordinator, they should have had me go do 20 minutes after this or do something like that. But my point is, it's extremely terrifying. And if you're a close-up worker who's working in restaurants or other stuff, every person gets the chance, anybody who's had a bad day has the chance to tell you to screw off and to put all of their anger into you. That being said, is if you're saying, okay, how do I deal with this? You say, okay, well, it's like being a server at a restaurant or anything else. We all have to deal with rejection at some level every single day when we're putting something out there. And you can say, okay, they're not rejecting me. They're rejecting the idea. Do they want to be entertained in this moment? That's all it is. And it can be, hey, do you guys like me? No, it's like, do you guys want to see something? Do you guys have a moment to see this or whatever? You compartmentalize what you're doing. And then if you need the confidence to do what you do, is you think about like, how many times have I done this before and people loved it and they said it was the best thing they've ever seen? And if you're a good magician, not a great magician, but if you're a good magician, you're going to have hundreds of people who have told you it's the most amazing thing they've ever seen because they've never seen magic up close.
Right.
And well, you just work from there.
That's I'm fond of saying everybody has only seen two magicians, that guy on TV and this guy, the one standing right in front of them at that moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because, you know, I'm 25 years into doing magic. No, 24 years into doing magic now. And I still have epiphanies about how to, as gracefully as possible, take a random person and guide them into a state where they really want to see magic. That's kind of where the whole philosophy of Scam School having openers, tweeners, and closers and even the stage show is built to where, like, I don't want to. And again, it's like, what else are you supposed to do? You walk up and say, hey, would you like to see a magic trick? It's flat, it's honest, it's direct, but it's also hugely ineffective because it doesn't guide people to the right state of mind to take them along the journey. And this is the kind of stuff that is so incredibly specialized. I mean, this matters to maybe 2,000 human beings on a part-time basis across America that they haven't figured out how to, you know, master that approach on there. I don't know. My point is we all become extremely specialized, and I'm sure we all have some part of our life that we're able to say like, oh, but I've got that. But then it's this other thing that I don't know what I'm doing. And for me, it was realizing how bad I was speaking extemporaneously on the microphone in the early days of Scam School and TV appearances before then. It took a long time. Took 10 years of hammering.
Flashback. Hey, I'm this Brian, and I'm gonna scam you all right now.
Yeah,
would you like to be scammed? Scammy school. How does scammy school sound, Bonnie? Does that sound good?
Think about scams. You want that to happen to you? Because I can make that happen to you.
Well, they think this is a scam. That's a problem. This is not a scam. This is not. I'm Brian Brushwood.
Yeah. No, I certainly wouldn't name the show Scam School.
Get ready to go to school.
Gonna get scammed and scam school. All right, got it.
Let me just say this about imposter syndrome in general. I think that the worst, like the most damaging that imposter syndrome can be to you is if it stops you from doing a thing. If you think that you right now are so far away from where other people are that it stops you from doing it, that's easily the most damaging. Like that is unhealthy. You should always want to take a first step into something and be realistic about your goals and your progress. But that's the biggest way that it can get in and do real damage to your life. Would you guys agree or disagree?
No, sure. I chose the things I do, and sometimes it was counter what people around me or close to me told me I could do. You know, I had a mentor who I really looked up to who told me, you know, I was not going to have a future in magic beyond just doing regular shows, you know, that just told me flat out, no, you're not. It's just not. I've seen it. It's not going to happen. And I had, you know, somebody looked up to, and a lot of people went to this person for advice, and they flat out told me it was never going to happen. It was unrealistic for me to do this. And I had to tell myself, and I had a good point of it. I had very low self-confidence, but I had to say kind of my head, F you. And if it's a matter of the work, of doing the work, that's going to be the difference, then I'm going to do the work, you know? And that's, I think my results have spoken for themselves, is I did pretty well in magic after that period in time, even though I was told by somebody who should have been encouraging that you weren't going to be able to do that. And, you know, and certainly you get imposter syndrome personally, you get, you know, that, but I'm like this person, like, they don't know. They have not managed their career as well enough as somebody who should know. And you have to make that decision. How badly do you want it? How badly do you want it? And I told myself, I want it bad enough to do the work. I will do the work. I'll do what it takes. Things I need to improve, I'll improve. And when it came close to, like, when I was getting my TV show, you know, hiring on-camera coaching, hiring people like this, even though I was good enough to get a pilot in a series, I said, I'm going to hire people and work with people to do an even better job, because I want to sort of elevate that, because it doesn't just stop once I get somebody's approval. That's not the judgment for me. It's me saying I got to continuously work on myself and improve that. So you're going to get people who are going to say you can't do it. And you can always have this. You can either, with yourself, when it's yourself, doubting yourself, you can either say, yeah, all right, I guess I won't. Or you can say, hey, I have a process to improve and get the work done. And that was Brian Brushwood, by the way, who told me.
Damn it. Yeah, man, it's weird. It's you sort of I don't know. Imposter syndrome doesn't feel great, but it does provide a very easy off ramp to a mental space of I am forever a beginner, forever a learner. You know, mm-hmm. that nothing I've done means I deserve anything. All that matters is I'm here. I'm at this event. There are 250 executives. They want to, in general, have a good time, and I have been selected to make that happen. And within those rules, what is the best I could do? Because guess what? The best you could do is all that you can do.
It is a very perfect, pervasive, you know, attitude. And I think that it's key to know that it's going on in everybody else's head. And I'm going to give you an example of are you familiar with the band, the Rock Bottom Remainders?
No. I think I've heard of them.
Yes.
So as a band goes, I would say that, you know, the math department of my high school, the teachers were a better band than the Rock Bottom Remainders, right? But the Rock Bottom Remainders, they performed around the country, parts around the world. You know, people love them. They get a fantastic reaction. They're not bad musicians. They're just not really.
I actually saw a signed tour poster of the Rock Bottom Remainders at your friend of mine, Andrew, Anthony Caruso's wedding rehearsal dinner was at a bookstore in Miami that had a signed by the whole band Rock Bottom Remainders poster.
So the Rock Bottom Remainders, it's got kind of a floaty membership group, but it includes Dave Barry, Stephen King, Amy Tan, Cynthia Hamill, Sam Barry, Scott Turow, and a number of other very famous published writers.
I do know about this band.
Yes.
I remember, I think it was one of the band members said that Stephen King's worst fear is that they're going to say, "Take it, Stephen."
Yeah. So it's, you know,
and yet somebody was left out. Still waiting for my call, Stephen.
Yeah. Wow. Where did half the band go after the middle of the show? and we keep waiting for they ask George R. R. Martin to write a song for them. He's going to get back to them on it. They're not bad, but you go to the music, you'd be like, oh, but what makes it fun is they're like, hey, we're going to go do this thing because we have fans that are going to like anything we do, which is sort of a neat thing. And I use that as an example is that there are, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know what, to my knowledge, Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, never written a really good novel.
Mm.
Never really. And Robert Plant seems to like Lord of the Rings, but I think he was really high when he read them because he seems to get the plot points messed up in his songs. But that's okay. The point is that, you know, that shouldn't mean that they shouldn't try to do these things. That you have people who are very exceptional at one thing that don't have the skills in other places. And sometimes you can develop them, though. Sometimes you can accomplish these things, but just you're just trying to be you. You're trying to be you. And if you is always building and improving and getting skills, then that's fine. Because you're not trying to be somebody else. You're trying to be you.
Heck yeah, man.
Unless you're Morgan Freeman.
Who's just awesome at everything.
All right. Any picks? Any recommendations?
Yeah, I got a weird pick. I was playing some Hearthstone and I needed ran out of my Netflix queue, and then up pops Tracy Morgan special. First since his accident, and it was kind of fun to see him getting back in the groove. I haven't seen any of his other stand-up specials. I know he's very, very funny whenever I see him on everything. This one, you could tell this is a ramp-up. This is a back-to-work thing, but having heard that, it's great to hear him making jokes at his own expense and his situation. But it's Tracy Morgan's Staying Alive.
Tracy Morgan's stand-up has kind of always been little hit or miss.
Yeah.
He's a personality and I would dare say an actor than he is a stand-up.
Well, and he also, it wasn't like he went and swung for the fences and it just wasn't the right joke at the right time or I wasn't in the right mood. It was fairly tame, fairly standard, set up punchline. And even the end bit, I'm like, oh, that's it. Okay. That's fine. It's good to see you're doing okay, Tracy. Yay.
You're doing all right.
Glad you're alive.
I have a pick. I can't believe that none of us have picked it yet. Unless we did, we might have. I finished Documentary Now, season 2.
Oh, is that out on a streamable platform?
Out on Netflix.
Oh, damn. Okay,
I'm Andrew back and I spent a lot of time talking about it to each other.
Is it not good?
It's not. It is good. I really enjoyed it. I think it's remarkable on some levels. In fact, sometimes on some of them, the art, the craft of the episodes are so good that you're just kind of like, oh, you're just kind of like doing a different version of the documentary, and it looks good. And many times it has the emotional beats that are good, but it's not quite there. That being said, there are some like just laugh out loud gems. It remains one of my favorite shows that are currently on television, and easily one of the most challenging to do. But man, Bill Hader and Fred Armisen, like, they're remarkable. And this in many ways is kind of their crowning achievement, with the different ways that they can go comedically and dramatically. Like, it's awesome.
The acting is fantastic, and absolutely fantastic. I would say that, like, first season, for me, the best episodes were when the documentary had its own narrative. It started in one spot, and then the documentary went into a different sort of – it's like, well, what
like,
if
like
this
the Grey
was
Gardens,
the case?
The very first one where it starts off
Sandy
as –
Sandy Passage.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was like that – what made Sandy Passage work for me was, one, their performances were fantastic, but also that it became a different kind of story, which was made it great. That's what made it so wonderful, was that. Same with Drones. Drones was this, and then it became this other kind of, oh my God, a documentary wouldn't go there, couldn't be about this. My issue with season two is most of them are just sort of straight up, you know, they're it's, hey, imagine if we did this documentary, but with a, you know, a version of this person, a different version of this person. And it doesn't go through that twist, and it doesn't change the narrative of what happens. And you just watch like, yeah, it's kind of like you just made up everything about the person, but you just followed the template of the documentary in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And I don't feel like I could have just watched the documentary for where it went. Yeah, other than the performances of Hader and Armisen are fantastic. Armisen, they are amazing. So for that, it's great for those guys watching them do stuff. But I didn't get this, oh, cool. It's like my problem with Saturday Night Live in the last 10 or 15 years is that sketches often have no endings, and they go on for 2 or 3 minutes longer than they need to. And then they just go to this weird, absurd kind of ending because they don't know how to end it. And they have a funny premise. It's a funny premise. And I can't wait to see how it ends. Oh, you don't. It's just premise. Okay. Yeah. With documentary now, it's like, hey, yeah, this is cool if one of these actors I loved played the part of the subject, but I want to see the documentary have its own story.
Yeah.
And a few of them do. A few of them do kind of twist things around. But others.
The bunker, or the, what was it? The bunker. That was fantastic.
The bunker is one of them, and that's a takeoff of political documentaries, and specifically the one about the Clinton campaign. And then the other one, the what was it, swimming to Saigon one?
Something like the swimming to Cambodia one, yeah.
Cambodia, they have that one also kind of subverts the genre a little bit.
Yeah.
And then others are good. Like, they got the one with it's their takeoff of The Kid Stays in the Picture, the famous
what's his name,
Robert Evans.
Yeah, there you go.
Evans doc, and it's like, you know, it's kind of amazing because it looks exactly like The Kid Stays in the Picture, which has a very distinctive visual style, but it's just kind of Bill Hader doing the voice and just making up.
So titles. Remember.
Which is funny. It's very, very funny.
But remember our conversation before we were talking about Documentary Now. I said, where am I right now? And I said, oh, I'm about to go watch this. You're like, yeah, I can't wait, or da da da. And I'm like, here's my fear.
Yeah.
And my fear is it's going to be The Kid Stays in the Picture, but with him, and they're not going to do the thing, follow their own sort of pathway onto it. And And that's what it was. That was my thing. It's like, it could be great, but I'm like, I'm not holding that out because this season, I don't think they've kind of done what I thought was great about the other one as much, which was subvert the, you know, the genre itself. But anyhow,
that being said, very worth watching. And it's not too long to get through. Like, they're all what, half hour episodes?
I think they're 40. Yeah.
And a two-parter.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I'm thinking of the Blue Jean Committee one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, everybody should check it out. It's all worth watching. If anything, there are moments where you're like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever that people should study. And every once in a while, it's not that, but it's still worth watching.
Yep. Cool. Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.